Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Open Discussion, Draft LDT Rule, Harmonization of ISO 13485, Memo on Reclassification of Certain Assays, and more. The presenter is Tim Stenzel, MD, CEO, Gray Haven LLC, Crystal, Minnesota.
First of all, it's a pleasure being here. I formed this company, Gray Haven, just to speak and to protect my family and myself. And I got speaker's insurance, which who knew there was such a thing as speaker's insurance? So Hartford helped me out for a bargain price, which because you all might act on something I say, and if I don't say things correctly... So first of all, I'm going to try my best to be accurate, but you should always double check. And the bottom line recommendation I have is don't be afraid of contacting the FDA if you have a question. They're there, surprisingly enough, to answer your questions and to help you. Toby Lowe was one of my, you know, best right-hand persons through the, we were on those town hall calls together, and I depended heavily on all the prep, because we would prep every week before those calls. We would, you know, we would have draft potential questions and answers. She had a team of people helping me out. So she made me, if I looked good at all ever, she made me look great. Okay, that's Toby. So you're in good hands sending a question to Toby. It's free. I don't know the turnaround time. There's no in-law turnaround time for her to answer questions, but I can guarantee they've prepared a team. They've probably seen every question under the sun already prior to this and can anticipate the answers, and they have those questions and answers drafted already. That's just how the FDA does things. They are incredibly well-organized, well-prepared, professional, the most professional organization I have ever worked for and with. And so just ask. So it's free. I don't know the turnaround time, but you can always ask through the free QSub pre-sub program as well. They're bound to give you answers in writing no later than 75 days after you have submitted your question. So, you know, ask good questions. Why? And any question is good. Just, you know, state your case, say, we want to know, you know, do we fall under this exemption? Are there any, you know, things we should worry about? But there's lots of exemptions in this reg. Now, what's not exempt is they're going to want to know, if you have an LDT, what it is, you know, what your performance is, not for review, prior to use. They just want to know. So, and if you accept this rule, the downside is, you're accepting that they clearly have oversight over LDT. So there might be somebody out there who will sue and try to win in court, but I think that's risky because you might end up with something worse in the end than what this is offering. This gives the FDA complete line of sight to all LDT testing in the United States. They know who the test developers are. They know the tests that they're offered. You've got to provide labeling, which it's going to look very similar to any kit labeling from an IVD test, FDA cleared or approved, that you've ever looked at. You know, what is the test? Who do we test with it? What are the sample types? You know, what is the test for? How is the test run, you know, as far as the technology goes, you know? And then what is the evidence that you generated to show that this test works? And they're going to have insight to all of that. So they could ask you questions if there's missing information or if they don't know that you've tested enough positive or enough negatives. They might ask, you know? So I think this raises the bar with a really, really light regulatory touch. And that's, in the end, what the FDA is most interested in. This is a very long game for the FDA, I believe. They're saying, okay, we're not going to see everything. Well, they weren't going to see everything under valid if that passed. I mean, I was heavily involved with the TA to Congress on valid. And, you know, I really liked the tech cert program, you know, and I really helped streamline that. That's one of my biggest impacts on that, was really helped streamline that and make it very workable And I don't think a lot of people really understood how streamlined that program was. But the biggest thing for Valid was they were going to know all of the testing, all the LDTs in the land would register listed on the FDA website so that not only the FDA would know, but everybody else would know what's offered, what the performance is. And then you let the free market, you know, take over. You know, and if company A or lab B has the best tests, then first of all, everybody can know what their claims are, know if, you know, do some work to find out if they're actually accurate, you know, like published literature, things like that. And then order the test from the provider they like the best, you know, either lab or kit, and get, you know, and in the end, hopefully, all quality, you know, rises on clinical testing. Payers have more insight. You know, it could make reimbursement easier in that the payers can all go to the FDA website if this is all public and look at your test, and that could really, you know, ease workflow. It's not like you're going to have people like Gabe and his team to help payers out. No getting around that. The FDA, just because it's even cleared or approved, doesn't mean you get reimbursement. All right. Enough of a preamble. Are there questions? All right. You're first up, Bob.
I mean, you have been on every side of the industry. Many people in this room don't really know that. Mm-hmm. You were a very distinguished molecular pathologist and stood up a lot of molecular tests. A distinguished member of the AMP, which is one of the groups in greatest opposition to and then you were on the IVD side and worked with John Bishop and some really great IVD executives, and now at FDA. Is there anything in the recent history leading up to this final rule that you would have preferred to see handled differently?
I would have preferred Congress, you know, passed a law at the end of 2022 and made it all clear, and all that effort by all the stakeholders had come up with a legislative solution. Put in how many years? 4 years of effort to get to that point. A lot of effort. And then all that effort maybe was for naught. But I think a lot of elements of Valid made it into this rule in the end. You know, and
one of the questions that's often asked, and I'm sure you've heard it, is if they had just left out the FDA modified label test where you're using 3 drops instead of 4 because you learned that that was something you validated. If they had excluded that and often just gone after the so-called bad actors, the reference labs that had these chemistries, algorithms, and they would have disclosed it. Would it have been easier, or do you still think we need the whole shooting match of
I don't know if you're going to be surprised by what I was most surprised about learning after I joined the FDA. But FDA is bound, and I'm still bound, by confidentiality rules that are extremely tight. Spend 5 years in prison if you break confidentiality. Okay, company confidential information. That's information that's good, proprietary, helpful to that company, but it's also bad information, right? So I'll just say it knocked my socks off, just how many, not as a percentage necessarily, but how many bad actors there are out there. And what an important job, which nobody understands unless you've been inside the FDA, of the important role across the board that the FDA plays. We deal with issues so severe that it would shock a lot of people. We deal with it on the down low as long as the company is working with us. As soon as they don't and they go off, then we have all sorts of tools which I and others have used freely over the years. So I knew there was some bad actors out there. There were the clear bad actors that everybody knows about, but there are a lot more than, and not just in this country. I mean, our experience with the serology tests early in COVID, I mean, we tried to put a box around serology tests early in order to focus our attention more on things that would really matter for COVID, which were diagnostic tests, not serology tests. And serology tests, frankly, were almost a total bomb for COVID. We knew that in March of 2020. You know, not a surprise. And we're like, why should we waste all of our time reviewing all these things? We'll just put them in a box. They can only make these claims. Well, suddenly, we didn't expect this. We were flooded by foreign tests that were just, you know, and they would also often use, domestic fronts. So, you know, the domestic player would call up their congressman and say, the FDA is not letting us do this, you know, and the congressman wouldn't even know that it was for a Chinese player, you know, and then we can't even tell Congress when they call us, and I have a direct conversation with some member of Congress, that is a Chinese test. We can't even say that, you know, but there might be some side of the aisle in Congress that might have been shocked that they were supporting somebody ultimately who was, you know, selling a Chinese test. So we were so happy when Ned agreed to at NCI to help us with serology tests. When we undid the guidance within 6 weeks, and we started testing at least rapids at NCI in their lab in Frederick, I think, and we worked with NCDC. We worked with NIH. We went multiple private partners to pull together collections of samples that we could use to evaluate these tests. Two-thirds of them failed in the NCI lab. Two-thirds. Okay? So, I don't know how, you know, I don't...
Did they fail because they were
too sensitive? Oh, there was nobody in serology. It was too sensitive. They usually failed more on sensitivity, right, than on specificity. Well, I mean, they usually failed because of false negatives rather than false positives. You know, we had to set some bar. I mean, it's pretty low, 70% positive for one of the markers, you know. Combined, you should get up to maybe 90%, you know. For someone who's exposed, has time to develop. We looked at time points, you know, 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks after exposure. Scientifically.
Did you all look into the impact on the
epidemiology? Okay, so the FDA is concerned not about traditional public health surveillance, you know, research. You know, go and do that. I mean, that's what that tool is for. It's for population surveys, you know, more than anything else. And it was suddenly being used to diagnose off-label. It was being used to, you know, promote to say, you know, if you're positive, you can't get infected again, you know, which is bogus. It's a bogus scientific claim. All right.
So, Tim, my question was, how do you, for example, happen in Europe with IVDR? There was no capacity to really to carry those tests here where there were more LGTs, probably tens of thousands of LGTs. Your department was very small, right? Congress is not necessarily able to appropriate quickly funds to kind of, how do we kind of find this potential bottleneck that can not only make things worse?
Okay, first of all, New York State. Anybody who wants to submit to New York State, they can do it now. Yeah, but they can do it now, right? And then they can maintain their approval for that. If you're inside of a health system, you're a lab that's serving that captive population, you're not doing reference testing outside of that. If there is an FDA-cleared approved test, yeah, use it. If there's not, or if you need to modify that test because there isn't the indication, there isn't the sample type you need, do it. The FDA is not going to ask for that. It's the really, you know, I think RUO kit manufacturers that are doing what they're doing to get around coming through the FDA are going to get squeezed long-term in this. I think that's actually a good thing. I think the small regional reference labs that are independent, they're not tied into a health center, they're probably most at risk. The academic centers, the private healthcare systems, everybody else is not. So would this always, anything benefit everybody equally? No. But there's nothing, you know, those regional labs, well, why not try to grow your business and get New York patients and have an option of going through New York rather than the FDA? Quality system requirements are going to mean much less if you get New York State authorization. So, you know, you got to weigh the business. Is it cheaper, easier to get New York State or to take everything through the FDA and have a much higher quality system for everything? You know, those are the folks that are probably going to be most effective negatively.
Whether you go to the FDA path or...
No, you. So as I said in my slide deck, I think New York State is going to be very, very busy. I think they should charge for any non-New York State lab to come to them, a reasonable fee that allows them to hire staff to do this, you know. But that's up to them. The FDA cannot control New York State. But I think, you know, the lion's share of large reference labs, almost all of their tests are New York State approved. So those are the centers that probably had the most LDT long menus of anybody. And so the FDA just, you know, took that whole thing off the table, you know, for them. And I'm sure EquiQuest, Mayo, ARUP, BRL, you know, everybody who needs New York State for their business model, I don't know why they wouldn't be extremely happy with this. Sorry, I'm trying to get everybody.
So my question is, how do you anticipate that this will impact diagnostic manufacturers that have products, like, say, an extraction kit for RNA or DNA that's
I should be repeating the question. So we're talking about kit manufacturers that may produce RUO-based DNA RNA extraction. So me and my test development over the years, whether it be at Duke when I opened and ran the molecular diagnostics lab there, or in industry, if you want to do it according to Hoyle, according to FDA rules, you can do that. You just take responsibility as a test developer for that RUO. If it's not an IVD product, it's not made under GMP. And so you can absolutely do that. The FDA just expects that entity to take full responsibility and not depend on the RUO manufacturer because they're not making things under GMP. You don't know the lot-to-lot variability unless you study that over time, unless you test with incoming QC the quality of each test. You test it at the limits. You don't test it with an easy sample. You might test it at, you know, the most problematic types of samples, low, something that needs high sensitivity, you do a low concentration. Or you know that this, you know, interferent is a problem for you if you don't get rid of it. So you test those extremes with each lot, you know, and then you know you're you know, just have a defined program, incoming QC, you know, to make sure that product is okay. So, you know, I think there's not a problem as long as those manufacturers don't promote their kit for clinical use in a way that is evident to all, because the FDA, I think, will come calling if you do. Oh, yeah, there are lots of questions.
Okay, so working on the IVD to prove analytical validity or clinical utility?
For FDA, clinical utility does not matter, except it does overlap for certain things like companion diagnostic or TDM sort of assays, where you're not just looking at the IVD, you're also looking at a drug or a drug product. And for a companion diagnostic, you know, you want to know, does that companion diagnostic correctly select the population that's going to respond to the drug? You're automatically moving in territory of clinical utility, not because of the IBD necessarily, but because of the necessity for the drug approval. But, you know, as far as class 3 products go, I mean, I found no, you know, limitation on any of the exempted categories of having to submit to the FDA that said that you had to bring class 3 products into the FDA. It's not there. That I could find.
I have a question it's sort of along the lines of clinical utility where there may be a kit or a reagent that's approved, let's say an NGS workflow or pharmacogenomics or something like that, where a lab can implement it, it's FDA approved, but then there's the whole interpretation end of it. How is that going to work? Will the labs that are doing their own internal interpretation have to go through FDA for that, like the clinical interpretation of those test results?
Anything, the question is, what do you do with an FDA-approved kit, you know, that where professional interpretation maybe go beyond what the FDA specifies in the label? I think the FDA is going to review that as the practice of medicine. If they've cleared or approved a kit, they've taken care of the things that are most important, and they realize there's an element for clinicians to use that information to benefit their patients. So that, I don't think they're going to come after you on that. But it never hurts to ask, okay?
Along those lines, as an example, because what I'm going to ask is kind of along the lines of what she is asking. For PD-L1 immunohistochemical staining system and scoring systems and which tumor, whether it's lung or breast or so on and so forth, and what I've seen in the literature, the variation, the discordance, so, I mean, how is that going to be dealt with? Because first of all, you have just the staining density versus the scoring systems versus used in different tumors. I mean, how would the FDA or New York State handle something like that?
I can tell you, so the question is about PD-L1, it's a very challenging biomarker. It's very challenging to test for it in paraffin-fixed tissues. There's different antibodies that apparently don't agree with one another. There are certain companies that have used certain antibodies. There are certain companies that have proprietary, you know, control over some of them. So I can't necessarily speak how New York State would do it, although they're going to look at analytical clinical validity for a specific antibody for a specific use case. And really the FDA does that. It's, you know, there's efforts to try to, there's been successful efforts to harmonize HER2 testing, HER2 IHC testing by the community. I think there's efforts by, this guy's name at Yale, David. Yeah, that was successful too. PD-L1 I think is a challenging biomarker. I mean, immunodrugs are incredibly important for cancer therapy and others. I'm a trained immunologist, but that one's behind me.
But your response that indicates to me that that's a huge gray area, and it's a really big issue. It's not only the antibodies, the specificity and sensitivity of them, but also there are different scoring systems depending on which tumor, and even across a single tumor, there's more than one scoring system. And if you look at how they actually score, pathologist scores under the microscope, I don't see how can somebody even get through.
Yeah, well, the FDA has approved lots of immunotherapy drugs that rely on PDA and lots of tests. So, you know, they've figured out how to do it, but they're not all harmonized. You can't use one test to predict all drugs. And there's specific tests for specific drugs. And it's very clear that you, in that case, not so much for almost everything else, but for that case, it's really hard to replace one test with another and get similar results in outcomes for the patient. So it is a scientifically challenging niche that I don't think anybody has an answer to yet.
Thank you.
But then I'd like to know, of her two positive patients, which ones are really going to respond and not respond. And now I got involved with her too back at Abbott, you know, working with, I was the liaison with Genentech, you know, at Abbott with our PathVision assay. And
did you know Paul Eppner?
Yeah.
So when you say that, I mean, I was involved with research back in the 80s on HER2, and it's so been going on for 40 years.
Yeah. Well, the pharma companies don't really want to decrease the number of patients that they're treating, but our system needs to be more efficient and treat just the right patients with just the right drug. So our system is not fully in balance yet. Let's. I know there might be other questions. We can come back to you after. Yeah.
Fish testing
going to
fall into this?
So, interesting, because of course... Oh, how is fish testing going to fall into this, you know? Well, first of all, if it's an LDT, it's going to be like any other LDT. So, but I have a little bit more knowledge, because when I first joined Abbott, I joined Visus, the recently purchased subsidiary. And then we merged into Abbott Molecular. So, and I was a Visus customer at Duke because I was medical director of the cytogenetics lab for years. So I knew and loved their technology. So, so it's like any other LDT. And, you know, when I first went to Abbott, we really ramped up the number of ASRs that were fish probes. And then one of my predecessors really hacked away at what ASRs really were, which was upsetting because you can have two primer probes and a Tachman probe, and that was okay to be an ASR, but you couldn't have two fish probes in a tube. And I'm like, Steve, that makes no sense. And I couldn't convince my predecessor that it made no sense. And so we backed off on some of the things that were ASRs, and we had to break apart things to stay in good graces of the FDA. That's part of the reason, really, my experience at Abbott was probably the most telling experience of why, when the FDA called, I said, well, let me take a look, because I think they still can learn some more innovative ways about dealing with technology so they don't slow it down. And, you know, that's the prime reason I went. And I tried to do my best when I was there. But yeah, it's just like any other ASR, you know, or any other LET. Just validate it properly, document it, works, you're good.
How do you see CMS's role in all of this?
Well, of course, CMS had a release, press release with Jeff Shuren on, you know, this is CMS role, this is FDA role. CMS has historically backed up that. This is nothing new, but it was a little bit of a coup to get CMS to say that publicly. So, but CMS does not like any other agency telling them what to do. I tried. I was mostly unsuccessful. You know. I thought, you know, we should make sure that labs can run COVID tests and not lose money, you know. I thought that was an important thing, you know, and I told CMS that. Anyways.
Do you think there will be any changes in how they handle things based on this?
No, I mean, there's going to be so many ways around submitting a test to the FDA, yet FDA, if the rule stays, is going to have ultimate authority over all IVD tests, including those developed by a single laboratory. And so FDA is going to, you know, have that turf, maintain it, say they've got it covered, and it's going to be hard for insurers to say, you have to come into the FDA. Now, they could, and this would take legislation, like, you know, for Medicare or Medicaid, they could come up with tiered systems. If you go through the FDA, you might get more. You know, I don't see that happening, you know. There's a bigger demographic problem that isn't easily solved and is an entirely different discussion, which I love having that discussion, but it's not today's topic.
Thank you.
There's some folks who suggested that with the increased burden of active review of all the entities, this might push the FDA
Okay, the question is, because of the burden of reviews, will the FDA push down-classify? They've already stated that publicly, that they want to down-classify. And, you know, that's good. At this point, based on the rule, the way it's written now, that's good. That's a bone thrown to kit developers, you know. So they didn't get as much out of this than they might have gotten out of Valid as far as easing the burdens of their test development. They could have fallen under tech cert. They aren't under tech cert here. But if everything's, almost everything's class two, then, you know, anybody who's done a PMA, and I've done multiple, and you lose years of your life every time you do a, you know, literally. Well, I, you know, if I'm out there running a lab, I'm going to look for ways not to submit to the FDA under this rule. I think the avenues are plentiful that are more palatable. Now, New York State probably will be overwhelmed, but maybe they charge labs a fee, which I don't think they do now, or a reasonable fee for those labs outside of New York. I think they serve New York, New York first. Their legislator's going to say, you got to continue doing for New York. But every lab in New York's been doing this already. So they're staffed to handle New York. What they might not be staffed for is handling more business. So, but that's solved by New York State saying, we're going to start charging a fee for non-New York labs. That's reasonable to hire the right staff to do their job. And maybe they'll do that, but they're not required to do that. So if they're swamped and the only way to get, you know, your test launches is to come to the FDA, that could increase test volumes. And the fact that they're now going to hopefully, after a couple of years, this is a long process to declassify, most down-classify, that is mostly out of the FDA's hands. There's all these things you got to go through, and it's mostly out. The timeline is driven mostly outside of FDA hands, so it just takes time.
You see a lab modified test following a similar.
So any modification to an FDA kit makes it an LDT in the FDA's eyes. So if you're under one of the exemptions, then you're fine. So you can submit that to New York State, you know, if that's you. If you're in a healthcare system, profit or no profit, that has a lab and, you know, a fixed patient population, you can make that modification as long as you, you know, do everything else, the quality system stuff, labeling, you're good. You don't have to come to the FDA.
What's the rationale for exemption of healthcare systems?
Well, they've laid that out carefully as they can. It is 500 and some pages long because all those arguments are very complex. But what they're going to say is they know the clinicians, they know the patients, it's an internal circle, and they have better oversight of what happens versus a pure reference lab business that doesn't have a connection to the clinicians, doesn't have any connection to the patients, and can't call, can't find out. So that's the overall rationale.
Makes sense. When you answer that question, I mean, I've had 10 years in the Army and 13 in the VA, so how could they possibly have exempted those two?
That is would be a very politically charged answer, and so I am not going to answer why DOD and VA are exempted. I know why, but I'm not saying.
Do you know what's the definition of an integrated health system? Will POLs, like small physician labs, be falling into that because they're testing their own patients and only their patients?
So the LDT can only be run in a high-complexity lab, not in a physician office lab.
But
Physician-owned labs could be, yes. I think that's an interesting angle, but they have to be bona fide patients of that, not just a reference lab.
Right, right. Because I work with a lot of physician-owned labs, and some of them are large. Well, they have 27 locations. Others, where it's just one or two locations, they only test their patient specimens. They don't receive any sort of reference. So would that fall under?
Probably it falls under an exemption if it's a physician-owned labs supporting just their network of patients. I don't see why not.
My favorite subject, NGS. We have the Lumina Res Espinal Venture of the Market Corp. We have an opportunity to go to open sequencing, right? Some new players.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like this regulation will kind of really
be a hard
burden for those new entries, right?
So new NGS developer, instrument developers, software developers for the instrument, you know. Will that be a higher burden? No, it's the same as it is right now. There's no prevention of any test developer, whether it's a kit manufacturer or a lab, to buy an RUO instrument from anywhere in the world. They just have to take full responsibility for all the validation and monitoring of that instrument and any reagents that come in that are RUO, you know, listed. No change for that. But what they can't do is that manufacturer come in and say, we have a clinical grade instrument, we're selling for clinical purposes unless they've got, you know, unless they're FDA regulated.
This morning you mentioned the warning letter for, you know, RUO, whatever. Could you expand a little bit more on that? Is that the use of RUO kits
in confinement zones? So, you can Google this easily and say, Agena Biosciences warning, FDA warning letter, and then you can read it for yourself. I'll give you the name to help you find it, but if you compare the warning letter to the 2013 RUO-IUO guidance and what the FDA warns against and what the FDA says this firm in their warning letter was doing, it lines up, you know, perfectly. I mean, it's like, anyways.
I have three questions based, I'm going to phrase them very quickly, but based on a quick reading of the rule, and your opinion. So unmet needs, when they say unmet needs, do they really mean there is not an alternate IVD that you can use? So leukemia, lymphoma, flow cytometry, for example.
So let's just take them one at a time.
Okay.
What does unmet needs mean? To me, when I'm reading that right now, preliminary, it means there's not an FDA cleared or approved test for that.
Minor modifications versus major modifications. So currently marketed pain management panel, you know, add a new drug to it. Do you, in your opinion, would that be a major modification?
So that's a nuance about certain categories of laboratory-developed test developers. When they have to come into the FDA, if they're coming into the FDA. That's a nuance we need to find out more about. But the question is, if there's a minor versus a major update to a test, you know, how do you know when to bring it to the FDA? Well, first of all, if you're covered under another, you know, exclusion, like if you're under New York State, if you make that modification, you can make the modification, but you validate, submit it to New York State, but you only launch it after you get New York State at least provisional approval, then you're covered by the FDA, for the FDA. If you're one of these labs within an integrated system, you can do whatever you want, basically. Make any.
The third question.
Yes.
So if a lab is co-owned by two different health systems, do you think that fits the description?
Well, the language I read in the final rule was, who owns the lab? Yeah, it's co-owned. They both own it. And all their patients within all the co-owners are covered. That's my reading. But it's always good to verify. Yes?
Yeah, so kind of the theme I keep hearing is clinical clarification of certain of the terms used in the final rule. Understanding it's a very long rule and everyone should read it, and there's some level of guidance within the rule. Is it reasonable to think, though, and I know FDA is hosting a webinar mid-May to kind of talk through it, that there might be some form of, like, Q&A or other form of draft that might come out next year as they get more of these questions and start to think through them?
So the FDA is concerned about lawsuits, okay? My advice to the lab community is don't sue on this one. You've got such a low bar. You'd be foolish to do it. But people do things, you know, that aren't always in their short, medium, and long-term best interests out of principle. And so someone could do that out of principle. But because there's potential lawsuit, FDA is going to take care of this all extremely careful and by the book. I expect that this webinar will be just like the webinar for the proposed rule. They will not take live questions. They will have a pre-prepared presentation. They will have pre-prepared Q&A. I don't know if there's an invitation for questions. Probably there would. Yeah. So we started doing that with our COVID town halls, and I really liked that because then I didn't have to take so many different cold call questions on the spot. Although when I wasn't extremely exhausted, I enjoyed helping people. So
you answered a lot of questions over and over with patients.
With a lot of patients.
But it was that in times where the world was appreciative of your immediate answer.
This rule is in some ways very complicated. I'm only making sense of it maybe more easily than perhaps some others because of my long history with the FDA. And in my, been there when a lot of things were discussed. So I have a tremendous leg up. But for someone who's novice to this, it's going to be very confusing, which is why one bullet on my slide says that people are going to ask FDA a lot of questions. And that's fine. I hope they can get back to you, in a really nice timeline. But if they're smart, they've already pre-prepared all the questions and the answers, and they have a team that says, this is the question, cut and paste in the email and send it out. And then there's going to be a line that says, if you have any further questions, let us know. So.
In that previous webinar, my recollection is that they said there are some class of tests that don't get the phase in here.
So I think what you're talking about is things that the FDA viewed and still views as devices, as non-LDTs, things like software, things like instrumentation, collection kits. Collection kit thing now under this final rule is they have created a gray area. I'm going to be direct-to-consumer, if it's pure direct-to-consumer, clearly it's not covered. You got to come in with a pure direct-to-consumer play. What I said before about RUO versions of software, scanners, instruments, reagents, RUO developers can sell them. But, for example, if you had software that said, you got this mutation, you can give this drug to the patient. That's the purpose of your software. That is not RUO. And the FDA will see right through that, and they'll come knocking on your door.
Software as a medical device, running that as a single test to get FDA potentially.
So the question is, if you have software in your submission to your New York state, what is New York going to do with that? Very clearly in the guidance, if New York approves it, it's fine. So that's a question for New York. How are they going to handle software? I would say that my knowledge of New York is they don't currently have such expertise that they can properly review software. But as I've said, if it's software that yields, say, raw data or identification of mutations and it's listed as RUO, and New York would not be giving approval to the software or an RUO instrument, they'd be giving an approval to the lab that is using that software or that instrument.
It must be more like a CDS on top of a test.
You'd have to give me more specifics about the CDS.
Basically giving clinical recommendations to the clinician in a whole genome context of what to do with
the... Right. So you have this mutation. What are your drug therapy options? So that is an interplay between New York State and FDA that I don't know has been decided, and that's going to be a nuance that might be in the final rule documentation. But again, I feel assured that if you ask New York State, they will give you an answer that you may or may not like, but they'll give you an answer.
Along that same lines, back to my other question with that. So if there's, say, pharmacogenomics, here's your test result, and you have some software that spits something out, an algorithm, but then you have, say, a PharmD or some expert professional, medical professional signing out that report to interpret it, it still fall under that.
So professional interpretation of lab results is the practice of medicine, and the FDA typically does not get involved in that. They get involved in is the lab saying you should give your patient this drug if you're not validated for that.
Yes.
Back, you're on. Okay. So the question is, how does this rule as written not stifle innovation among small lab developers? Well, the FDA would say that it's not a level playing field when you compare a small lab developer to a small IVD kit developer who might be doing exactly the same thing. Their focus on this rule is they want somebody looking over everybody's shoulders. And if it's not the FDA, fine, but it has to be New York State. It has to be your integrated health system. And as I said at the beginning, I think small reference lab LDTs are, they're going to have the most challenge. So you have to decide whether you're going to take things through the FDA or you're going to take it through New York State, or are you going to team up with a healthcare system and that's your sandbox for your company, at least at this point. Until maybe you get enough revenue to say, we're going to take it to New York State, or we're going to take it to the FDA. There's always a way to, find a way forward if you've got something really good. And I know, there's not a lot of investment in diagnostics now, particularly genetic signatures and things like this, because the Myriad decision, which took away a lot of innovative funding of innovation and guaranteed some level of reimbursement due to patent positions. And so I argued very loudly, very, publicly against, what AMP was looking at doing. And I was probably the N of one within all of AMP. Yeah. That's up to Congress, but they're rather dysfunctional right now, so I wouldn't depend on that.
If you go back to unmet need, on the story is we'll have a, you know, an IUC or a system that is, the company will become FDA approved for that probe, but we can get it elsewhere. Are you all significantly cheaper?
Yeah. Or you can dilute the reagent that you buy from my company and you know, test 5 patients instead of 1. Yeah, I know it.
So we're not going to be required to test.
No. So the question is, can you use RUO products instead of the FDA-approved or cleared product? That's going to be hard unless you're New York State approved for that.
Anybody in your job had to be a pretty decent psychologist, I'm sure. Why do you think there was such vehement opposition to this whole idea of regulating LDTs in the last few years? The ASR exemption more or less sailed through. Everyone was more or less happy. Nothing terrible seemed to happen. But this one has really gotten the hackles up of a lot of people.
So why does active FDA oversight of LDTs upset so many people? Because they've been free to do what they want for a long time. The ASR rule was for manufacturers. It wasn't required of labs to use them.
Along those lines, where did the organization place the psychiatric aid station for us at the end of this?
I approve the psychiatric aid station. So I approve of appropriate medical care for everybody. So if you need it, go for it. But really, I think if you fall under one of these relatively wide and easy exemptions, you're going to decide that maybe this isn't so bad. That's my read on things. But it's up to you. All right, are we out of time? All right. Thank you. Great question.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.